2 Kings and the 12th chapter. It's a compendium of chapter 11 as well. Those two to go together just like chapters 9 and 10 go together. Before we get into our study, though, if you would bow with me in prayer and we'll approach God together. Heavenly Father, we thank you for today. We thank you for the blessing that it is to reach to you through prayer. And as you listen to our hearts, please respond with power and goodness. Help us to understand your message. Help our faith to mature and grow. Challenge us to be more like your Son. And allow our efforts and our endeavors to be an honor to you. Forgive us of our sins. And this is our prayer in your Son's name. Amen. All right. I think I went backwards somehow. All right, so we are in 2 Kings chapter 12. This is that two-part set of the Kings section where we have a section of biblical text that kind of restates similar events and realities to us in a very interesting way. As we've been doing with this text, we're paying attention to a couple of things. Number one, we're paying attention to the history of Israel in its situation. The historical side of the text is the first important thing we can learn from it. Number two, we're paying attention to the theological impact of the text. What is God trying to teach us? You may have heard people over the course of your lives describe theology in different ways. And some of the ways it gets described is kind of makes you nervous. Like, I don't understand that or know what that is. Here's a simplified idea of the practical side of theology. Theology is just knowledge about God or God trying to tell us something. You do theology anytime you do one simple thing. Read one passage and put it next to another passage. If you read two separate scriptures together and think about what they mean together, you are now what they call a theologian. That's all that's taking place. It's not that complicated. We overcomplicate it in a lot of ways because it's a big word. There's other big words we can't even pronounce. We don't worry about those. Theology is one that we can chew on. But really, that's all we're trying to do is take a couple Bible passages and understand what God is doing with it. What he's trying to teach us. What should we know? So first thing, history. Second thing, theology. And then there's one thread that goes through the Bible. We've talked about it in a lot of ways. The thread of the Bible shows us whom?
Jesus,
right? And sometimes we do that thread looking from the standpoint of what does one book tell us about Jesus or one chapter. But the thread is always there. The thread comes to its fulfillment in the New Testament. We identify passages of super familiarity like Romans chapter 15 and verse 4, where we learn and remind ourselves that these things were written for our learning. And that learning should drive us to have hope. And hope in the New Testament is really summed up in Jesus. And so theology drives us to Jesus. The history, the theology, and the Christ-centric or Christocentric nature of the Bible is what we look at. I'm going to go ahead and reveal something that we've kind of hinted at that we'll probably look at a second time. And this comes in looking at chapters 9 and 10 and chapters 10 and 11 of 2 Kings. You may have noticed some of these things that have appeared on repeat as you've read through the text. There are repetitions throughout the entire Bible. One of the first ones you find is actually all the way back in Genesis in the earlier chapters. And in that kind of genealogical section where everyone lives and dies. What stands out as different in that text where this guy lived, this guy died? This guy lived, this guy died. Is anyone different in that whole sequence? Pro tip, somebody is. Because that's why I'm asking the question.
Enoch.
Yeah. Everybody else lives and dies. Enoch didn't. That makes Enoch rise above. And we ask questions. We do theology. Why is Enoch different? What's different about him? What's going on that has him living but not dying like everybody else? And we get a spiritual answer to that. A kind of, okay, his heart's different. His motivation is different. Same thing happens here. A lot of similarities. Similarities can cause us to ask those questions of why are these texts together? What's going on? Is there tension? Are they different? Are they the same? Are they supposed to pull on us? So in quick terms, and we'll see this in chapter 12 when we read through some of this, Jehu and Joash. Jehu, coronated in secret. Trumpets announce the king. Jehu is king. Treason takes place. Big statement there. The queen mother is killed. Jehu destroys the house of Baal, the false gods. Jehu does not destroy the high places. Joash, chapters 11 and 12. Remember, he's the one who is the protected child. Coronated in secret. Trumpets announce the king. Long live the king. Treason is the cry. The queen mother is killed. The house of Baal or Baal is destroyed. But he does not destroy the high places. Now, when you just read through for the history, do you always note that when you're reading through just for the history? I can tell you, I never noticed it the first couple times reading through it. I didn't see that repetitive sequence taking place. Nor did I necessarily catch the theological possibilities either, because I was bound up on the historical plane. Plus, this actually is what helps us see Jesus. Seeing these things, this repetition and missing pieces of the puzzle, helps us go, well, what's lacking here? So, before we again get into the reading of chapter 12, what do you notice right off the top of this comparative analysis of these two kings and their reigns?
They did not destroy the high places.
High places. It's like, if you tell me something one time, it might be important, right? But if you tell me something twice, do you think the person telling it believes it's important? Have you ever heard someone say something like, or to similar of, if God tells you something once, that's enough, right? That's a hermeneutic we sometimes use to understand the Bible, that once is enough. Like some simple statement should be enough. But does he usually only tell us things once? No. Why is that the case? Why does he tell us things more than one time? Yeah, but sometimes we just don't listen. We're dull of hearing. We're stubborn. The New Testament actually makes an explicit command, right? To give attention to reading, to press into remembrance. Like, there's an expectation there. So there's a reason, then, that the high places are important. What might be that reason? Just kind of thinking through before we kind of peck at some of the feathers around this chicken that we might put on the grill. Mark?
Well, if you don't destroy the high places, you're going to get the pizza you ordered.
That's right. It's going to recycle.
Yeah.
Right. I cleaned out the bath, right? But I didn't clean out the pipes. Because it's just going to come back dirty water again. Every single cycle is going to be the same way. There's some biblical illustrations that God teaches through, that we read of, that are same way. The principle of leaven is in Old Testament and New Testament on the same premise. Think about the communal feast type setting of the Passover and leaven in that context. There's literal sides of leaven and symbolic sides of leaven in that picture. But what was the expectation? What was the goal? On the practical, historical side, what were they supposed to try to do with leaven during this time period? Get it out, right? Now, on a practical level, Israel kind of morphed through variations of it, even to today, in the practice of Jewish families today, they will symbolically cleanse out the leaven from their house, even if they're not religious Jewish individuals and just historical, genetic, Jewish kind of observance of the practice, they still throw the leaven out, all right? But is that actually doing anything for them, aside from the temple's existence and all that stuff? Just like, oh, I just kind of threw the leaven out. New Testament, with the teachings of Jesus and the writings of Paul and the apostles, is leaving false leaven, damaging leaven around healthy? Yeah. It's just not. It leavens the whole lump. How much? Completely, wholly, every ounce of it. Like, I don't even necessarily understand all the mechanics of leaven. I just know that it's what it, that's what it does. It grows and grows and grows until it occupies all the space and it's devoured everything that's fuel for it, all those sugars and starches. So that's going on here as well. So let's get into the text a little bit. We've got all that backdrop. We've seen a little historical context. We see this repeat there. And a side note, this is not the only time that these kind of repeats occur in the text, right? We've seen a lot of these. You see that in the story of Judges, that circle, that spiral of doom that they go on, where things repeat and repeat, and they go from like kind of bad to dumpster fire. Like that's the text of Judges, where it's really bad at the beginning and it's supremely awful at the end. So let's look at the text here, and we're going to read parts of chapter 12, if not all of it, of 2 Kings. The 12th chapter, and we'll kind of break it up a little bit to share the load. That also allows me not to talk as much. Les, would you read verses 1 through verse 8? And Mark, if you could read verses 9 through 16. And then, let's see, Bobby, would you finish out the chapter for us? Now that's going to be verses 17 through 21. Less than Mark than Bobby is the cycle.
Jehoash was 7 years old when he began to reign. Verse 4. In the 7th year of Jehu, Jehoash began to reign. He reigned 40 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Zibiah, or Sheba. And Jehoash did what was right in the eyes of the Lord all his days, because Jehoiada the priest instructed him. Nevertheless, the high places were not taken away. People continued to sacrifice and make offerings on the high places. Jehoash said to the priest, all the money of the holy things that is brought into the house of the Lord, the money which each man has assessed, the money from the assessment of persons, and the money that a man's heart prompts him to bring to the house of the Lord, let the priest take each from his donor, and let them repair the house wherever any need of repairs is discovered. But by the 23rd year of King Jehoash, the priest had made no repairs on the house. Therefore, King Jehoash summoned Jehoiada, the priest, and the other priests, and said to them, why are you not repairing the house? And therefore, take no more money from your donors, but hand it over for the repair of the house. So the priest agreed that they should take no more money from the people, and that they should not, repair the house.
But Jehoiada the priest took a chest and tore a hole in its lid and put it inside the altar, on the right side as one comes into the house of the Lord. And the priest who guarded the threshold put in it all the money which was brought into the house of the Lord. When they saw that there was much money in the chest, the king's scribe and the high priest came up and tied it in bags and counted the money which was found in the house of the Lord. They gave the money which was weighed out into the hands of those who did the work, who had the oversight of the house of the Lord. And they paid it out to the carpenters and the builders who worked on the house of the Lord, and to the masons and the stone cutters, and for blind timber and hewn stone to repair the damages to the house of the Lord, and for all that was laid out for the house to repair it. But there were not made for the house of the Lord silver cups, snuffers, bowls, trumpets, any vessels of gold or vessels of silver from the money which was brought into the house of the Lord. But they gave that to those who did the work, and with it they repaired the house of the Lord. Moreover, they did not require an accounting from the men into whose hand they gave the money to pay to those who did the work, for they dealt faithfully. And the money from the guilt offerings and the money from the sin offerings was not brought into the house of the Lord. It was for the priests.
And Hazael, king of Assyria, went up and fought against Gad and took it. And Hazael set his face to go up to Jerusalem. And Jehoash, king of Judah, took all the hallowed pains that Jehoshaphat and Jerem and Ahaziah, his father, king of Judah, had dedicated, and it was hallowed, and his treasure of the house of the Lord and in the king's house, and sent it to Hazael, king of Assyria. And he went away from Jerusalem. And the rest of the acts of Joash and all that he did, they are not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah. And his servant arose and made a conspiracy and slew Joash in the house of Miller, which went down to Salah. For Jezebel, the son of Shimeah, and Zobadab, the son of Shimeah, his servant, smote him, and he died. And they brought his body and buried him with his father in the city of David. And Amaziah, his son, reigned in his stead.
All right, so there's a lot of familiar storytelling that God's people do for us here. But some of it is maybe more challenging than others. The text begins by showing the king that we're looking at as basically kind of David, Saul, Solomon. It says, oh, he reigned 40 years. That's like the standard rounded off number for kings. If you want to say that this person was a solid king, you're going to say 40 years. And keep in mind that the historical record does this sometimes, where it doesn't really concern so much with getting days and months in there, just getting the raw details of he served long enough to be in this class of a solid king, 40-year king. That means something, considering our audience is now looking back to that event and is supposed to think about that and say, okay, but wait a minute. He started like a David, right? Started out, he was powerful and there's good that outcomes, but there's something that goes on underneath it that churns it to not be a David and not be a good, everything's great outcome. And we see some of that is taking place in this power shift, power struggle. In this chapter, in 2 Kings chapter 12, in the 1st and 2nd Kings texts, this is our first mention of the temple since 1 Kings chapter 15. That's a long time in the history of Israel that they just kind of go, temple? Nobody cares. Because if you're asked David, is the temple really important? David thought it was so important that he requested and asked if he could be the one who could build it. And he was not allowed to do so. And yet he still went through all the labor and all the work to get it ready so that someone else could do it. When Solomon builds his palace, his chachal, his big house, just as a side note, in the Old Testament, whenever you read the words for palace or temple, it's the same word. Context helps us understand what we're talking about. They're the same word, and it has a root that means big house. So anytime you see temple, palace, go into the big house. Context says, is it a priest or is it a king's house? So if the initial house of God, the big house, was supposed to be the big house in the big city, and then somebody built a bigger house in the big house, who's trying to be like, I don't know, the Egyptians all the time, and isn't every choice he makes, that creates this power struggle. And so all the way into 1 Kings 15, temple makes a play for prominence. 1 Kings 15 till now, it's all about the other big house. But now it's coming back. And we see something taking place. Who is guiding this young king? We met him last chapter.
A priest,
right? And it certainly looks like, and I think it's fair to say, his motives are pretty genuine. He doesn't seem to be trying to make himself more powerful. Nor is he trying to take the throne. Has that happened in Israel before, where people want the throne, they just kind of go out and say, I'm going to take it? Yeah. Which is weird, because basically this guy's the king, as a regent, but never pushes to be the king as a legitimate king. And that helps us refine the idea that his character is strong. Now, the rest of the people around him might be a different story, but we see that from him. And we also then eventually see, as the text kind of reads forward, that the king and the priest are concerned that the work goes forth as planned. Hey, we got all this money that's supposed to be coming in. How come I'm not seeing any work taking place? You ever paid for something and like workers are supposed to go out and be doing it, and then you go out to the job site and it's a big box of nothing? That's a normal thing in human endeavors. But now you've got basically the two occupants of the two big houses, the two hakals, the big houses in Israel, saying, hey, no, this is what we're supposed to be doing. Their combined leadership might allows them to correct this in very simplistic ways. And their solution is super simple. We're to cut out all the middleman. Like literally, it's just, all right, it's going to be a box and it's going to go straight into the hole. This text here is one that often gets brought up in short talks and sermons and illustrations of all kinds of things. But it does solve the problem, right? Setting aside all the ways we kind of shop around it, this fixes this issue and ensures all these steps that take place afterwards. It's sealed up, it's counted out, it goes to the workers, the repairs are getting done. But remember, we've got our chart up here. Temple gets announced, temple gets repaired, high prices are still a thing. And we're going to see some of this play itself out in the latter part of the text. Because around the middle part of chapter 12, that power that was flowing into the temple again flows out. Because the king becomes king again, like starts to enact himself as king. And that's a normal ebb and flow in the historical record of Israel. You think about it, David as king, building the premise for the temple, tabernacle phase, temple's not built yet. Who had all the power in Israel at that point? By God's decision, David did. The temple wasn't the power. The temple is a place where they could meet God. We tend to think, and this is the last step for that, we tend to think that the big house in any country is the power. If I ask this question, where's the power in America? What's our classic answer? Washington, D.C., that's the big city. What's the big house? Not the jail, that's where everyone else ends up eventually.
The White House.
But which house is bigger? The White House or the house that Congress inhabits?
Congress.
Oh yeah, by far. Especially in all the little Congress critters that live underneath it and spread out for acres of space underneath it. And you could argue all day long about who actually has more power. The executive branch or the legislative branch or the judicial branch. They fight constantly by the nature of their adversarial relationship. Those physical structures, even the ones designed by God or authorized by God, aren't still ever the true representation of power. God's dispensing his power through those vessels or vassals. You can look at it either way. Both words seem to work there. So before we get into verse 17, which is the plunder moment where you see the results of this, what are you guys thinking so far? We're going to ask our classic questions at the end, so you'll get to have your I like, don't like stuff at the end of the study. But what is important to you, or what did you notice in your readings, or what things are important for us as a group at this point, all the way through verse 16? And this is also where you can tell me, hey, I was wrong, and you can correct me too. That's a fair thing. Les first, and then Mark.
What had the priest been doing with all that money all that time?
Yeah, they're like, what's going on with that money? And how does that look? Again, if the high places are the places of corruption, the priests are spread out everywhere. You know where that money's been going? It's not been going to the temple. There's only two options. Either it's not been taken up, or it has been taken up, but it's fallen into a different hole. And that hole is known as somebody else's pocket. Mark?
Looks like kind of the first part of his reign, the people are still going to the high places, but he is like David in a true sense of, I don't care what the people are doing. I'm not going to let the people lead me. Mm-hmm. Maybe that would be the...
Right.
I'm going to lead, and if I'm going to work on... It, you read that text, and it's house of the Lord, house of the Lord, house of the Lord. At least at that point in his reign, he knows where the emphasis should be. Even if the people are not all on the same page, it's my job to lead.
Right. And this is a normal thing to see a great start. And look, up through verse 16 or so, it's like we got a perfect king here. He's going to reign for 40 years. He's doing all the right moves. Here's a little secret behind the scenes kind of things. The text of Chronicles lists out a lot of other stuff in his story that can kind of make this more complicated. But that's why it's in Chronicles, not here. They're teaching us different things. What else? Anything else before we kind of scoot forward? All right, so what happens in verses 17 and 18 that is important to shift this nearly perfect king off of his little primrose path that he's on where everything seems perfect? What happens with kings that either go to or on the receiving end of what?
War.
If you think back to Saul, what's the role of a king according to God and the people? Take our people and go out to war. And where should David be as a classic illustration of that principle? He should be out to war. Everyone goes out to war. Because you should be sacking the neighbors and taking their stuff. That's the underlying reason for that. And if we don't go out and sack and take their stuff, they'll come and sack and take our stuff. And if we don't have enough stuff, they'll leave us alone. We have too much stuff, but not enough men. They'll just come and take it. And so they're in that condition where they don't have enough men, but they got stuff, they think. And so what's their solution to this problem when Hazael, the king of Syria, comes up?
Pay him off.
Straight up bribe. By the way, does that happen today? Do we pay people off in order to make them not go to war?
Yes.
Do you know what aid is to foreign nations that have no physical structures in them except for a landing strip for our planes? That's us paying them off. Like that's all that it is. And it may do good in the country, and it may do good other ways. But most of that aid is actually Department of Defense. We need to land a plane here. And so could you make an agreement with those people so we can land a plane here? Because we need to go over there, because those people over there are trying to steal people from stuff from those folks over there. And we need to get there. So this is not a new thing. Very pragmatic. This is not a moral judgment on it. It's a pragmatic look at it. But where does he get the money to pay off? Where does our king find his cash? Well, he gets it from us, but this...
Holy thing from the temple.
Right. Now, think about this for a moment. From a standpoint of not whether or not he knows what to do, but based on your reading of the Bible, what does God think about the things that have been dedicated to his service?
They're his.
Like, they're his now. Like a general kind of premise. And it's not because the thing matters. A whole people is dedicated to his service. God tells one of his servants, I can raise up a people from these stones. But it's the underlying picture that now is a big deal. So we have a king that started off perfect. You know, he's basically the personification of remember the Titans, you'll be perfect in every way. And then now he's grounded, you know, because he did not step through the last, you know, series of exercises. And instead, takes all these things that have been dedicated to holy or sacred service and sells them off. How does that impact the rest of his reign when you think about it? Not, the text tells us some more in a second, but now you think about him. Is he a good king or a bad king?
Well, they didn't no record here before they ever consulted God about it, or prayed to him, or if they kind of take the matter in their own hands.
Right. There's a lot of what seems like good intended behavior from the high priest, and I think I would agree and say I think his morals are good, his motives are good, his intentions are good. But there's not this, what we had seen behalf with the high prophets. Hey, let's go talk to God first before we do this. Let's check with what our Creator, Sustainer, and King actually says for us to do. That's not recorded for us here. Mark?
Yes. He's not all in. It's things we're working on it, but once my life might be on the line, or I got some skin in the game now, how much do I trust God? It was well noted. There could have been prayer. There could have been, we'll seek God through the prophets, etc. But let's just sell off some of that sacred. I mean, it's called sacred.
Yeah.
That should jump out. He took sacred, holy things and gave them to this enemy. And like, well, what if the guy shows up? What are you going to do? You know, it's like there's not an unlimited supply of that sort of stuff.
Right. And you think about this on a practical level. Anything that is in the word space of holy or sacred comes from the same word family. They're all in the same group. And we tend to give it the simple definition of set apart. That's not the big picture, but it's really workable. It's a usable definition. So these things have been dedicated or set apart to a purpose for them. That implies that when you're using them for other stuff, there's consequences. Here's the illustration. I've used this over the years. It could be that in one of your family members' houses, there's a gravy boat, right, that only comes out for Thanksgiving. It's been dedicated for that purpose and that meal. And unless you're one of the priests, which I never am, I'm never allowed to touch those special gravy boats, then it's an unauthorized practice. Like, and you may have been houses like that. You may have a gravy boat that's like your third generation gravy boat. And look, I got fumbly fingers. That's a fair choice to say, no, you shouldn't really be touching that. Like, that's fine. That's what we're seeing here. We're seeing that same concept that God said, this is for this. And now they're like, meh, we got a bill to pay. In the Old Testament prior to this, are there solutions when Israel doesn't have enough men or money to these fights? Well, yeah, like what kind of solutions do we find? Any amazing ones?
A tent peg.
Yeah. How about when they're leaving Egypt, crossing the Red Sea? Does he send any helpers to them? There's angels to fight for them, like slaughter. It's not even like, hey, just get away. We're going to shoo you away with winds. Straight up go to war and decimate the enemy's level of involvement on the Elohim, on the Yahweh, on the God side. And they're pushing that way. And their response here now is, well, we got some pocket change in the temple. We'll buy you off. And it's not just pocket change. It's a lot. It's a substantial and significant site of wealth for the kingdom. In the idealized state for Israel, the king's house is small, and the temple is where the wealth is. Solomon kind of upended that a little bit. Verses 19 through 21 tell us the Paul Harvey of the king's life, the rest of the story. And that's where we get this cycle. He was coronated in secret. He came into his office as a king in essence, a coup d'etat. And he survived, right? And how does he go out? Coup d'etat. We're going to cut off the head of the beast and take it over. And another one shall rise in his place. This is the ebb and flow of kingship in Israel. If we go back to our three premises before we get to the last 5 minutes or so with our questions that we typically ask. The historical side tells us, at least from my first read of it, it's another failed king in Israel. Like, he's better than some, right? He's no Ahab. Like, I'm not going to put him on that level. Mark?
The older I get, the importance of finishing strong.
Yeah.
It's not always easy to finish strong, but that's the goal. Make sure you finish strong and run right through that tape at the end, and this guy doesn't.
First step can be fun. The thousandth step, it's more like work. You know, the 10,000th step, talk to homemakers over the years and ask them when they started making their first week's worth of meals, how that meal planning feels after 40 years of making meals. Most of them will say, like, I didn't realize my whole life was going to be figuring out what to eat, you know, what to cook each week. Because Because the fun kind of fades unless you change it up a little bit and you increase those things. And that's finishing.
Yeah, I think Cindy have always talked about at this point in my life, the goal right now is not to do anything stupid. As far as, because we've seen people at times that have hit 60 or whatever, and spiritually, all of a sudden, like, what happened? So, yes.
Yeah, the classic shooters, gunfighters phrase, don't do stupid things with stupid people in stupid places, is a standard rule for life. I think it works in the gunfighter arena, and it certainly works in the spiritual arena. It's a nice equal thing there. Second thing, so that's our historical side. We're seeing that lack of finish for the king. Theology. What is God trying to tell us? Not so much about Christ specifically, which is kind of our thread that goes through. But what are some of those tensions? Because we've got the chart up here that shows us this contrast of two kings that are actually not contrasted at all. But what are we supposed to see here? And the answer is, I'm not sure. That's fine too. That's a good parsable. I got some that we can pay attention to. But what do you see here is another way to think about it.
We didn't finish the job.
Right, and this is not a new not finishing. When they occupy the land, did they leave anybody in the dirt after they came in hanging around? Yeah. Solomon is the personification of leaven in the camp. And he invites it in. Even our great King David, it's not the child king, the teenage king, that we sometimes see him as, that makes his Bathsheba choices. It's the mature man of God who makes those Bathsheba choices. He's older. There's not tomfoolery because he's stupid and ignorant. It's he's empowered and not humble. I will suggest to you that something you can kind of see in this is that both Jehu and Joash, to a certain degree, they are not making the choices. They are implementing the choices. And that bought-in nature is something theologically that God is asking us to be for. Jehu is a hard man, firm and strong, and a man of war, much like David. But he's enacting God's choice. And once God's requests of him fade, then his actions veer off into other directions, and so do those around him. With Joash, it's the same thing. The priest is pushing him in the moral direction, and when the priest's power is now sublimated and less, he just does what kings do. I don't want to go to war. War sounds bad. You know what sounds better? Not dying. That's the pragmatist view of it. And theologically, that teaches about what God should expect from us. That our pragmatic choices should never rise above God's expectations for us morally and spiritually. Richard, do you have something? Or are you doing that? You're doing your normal. I have a question or a comment.
Contemplating my words. I guess for me, one of the things that jumps out is not destroying the high places, and that actually goes all the way through. And I'm gonna make a conclusion here. And that only goes through the discussion with the woman at the well, mm-hmm. who asks about, hey, we've been worshiping at this mountain. And Jesus tells her that there's a better thing coming.
Right.
And so it continues throughout that entire generations for generations.
Yeah, it survives the captivity.
Yeah.
When we tell ourselves, kind of not accurately, that idolatry was crushed in Israel when they went to captivity. Because they kept all their high places, and they were still an idolatrous people. They just changed the form of their idolatry to a new form. Which, if you read through Romans, Gentiles do the same thing. They're idol worshippers of their own kind. They've made their own God and their own method of worship. Last bit, the threat of Jesus, real quick, before we ask our fun questions, or at least a couple of them. Jesus exists throughout most of the Samuel King's Chronicle space as the illustration of what's missing. With Jesus, he's the finisher. Whereas these kings, they start well. Sometimes they self-correct. But rarely do they finish well. David doesn't finish well. His spiritual status is on the sidebar there, but his role as king, he's bedside. And we're seeing others begin to infight the moment his weakness is exposed. All the parties of the king royal court are all fighting with one another. So none of them have the kind of tenacity to finish that the stable nature of Jesus brings to the table. You can also see the justice of Jesus in contrast to these kings. And so really, he's all the things that are missing in the text is a way to think about the theology of show me Jesus through all of these things. And then when we read the New Testament, a lot of times it will appeal to these historical events and show how Jesus' impact is bouncing off of those realities. All right. So sometimes we ask these in order. We're not going to do that tonight. You can answer any one of these questions in any order you prefer. So what'd you like, what'd you not like? What are things, Les already gave us one of those earlier of things. He wants to know where that money was going, although I think we're supposed to understand where it's going when we read it. What'd you like or not like? Those are fair questions in this part of the text. And I like awkward silences while I wait for answers.
I'll throw one out there just in time. So we talked a little bit about leadership in the early years, and really I think the leadership came from the priest. But then I have to go back and go, how do you wait for 23 years and not see progress from what you asked to do 23 years ago? Where's the milestones? Where's the check back?
Yeah.
And I struggle with that as far as he did everything in the right in the sight of God. But then you've got examples like this. You've got examples like pulling all the sacred items. So my mind struggles a bit. I mean, maybe he was all right for the most part. But we've got some contrast in there as well.
Yeah, something to remember about the historical books throughout the entire Bible is they are purpose written. God has selected the parts of their lives that meet his theological and Christological goals. What I want my people to know about me, and what I want my people to know about Christ. And so they're all selected that way. And so there's a lot of these lives that we simply don't know about. Like, it's just not even included. And we just assume that they're stable creatures. Like, they were buried in the ground in between each of the times we see them, and they did not change morally. Has anyone's favorite beverage changed since childhood? Like when you were like 7 to now? I think most of us were, yeah. I used to drink milk like it was going out of style. Like that was the only thing I would drink all the way through high school just about. Like barely can keep the house stocked with it. And now I drink milk with cookies. Because that's the pairing that exists in my life that's perfect. Milk and cookies is a great pair. So we change. Like we move in small ways and in big ways. All these kings do too. And I will suggest the simple answer that I come from there is he's changing in the middle space. He's growing into his leadership, and he picks an easy win in the text. Hey, this is something we should be doing. Let's go fix this. And then the next time we see him, he's in charge for real, and the priest is less and less, and now it's a little different. Now he's making a choice rather than the priest guiding that choice, and we see how poorly it ends. Here's something else. This is something like in the sense of like and don't like. The center of Israel keeps shifting around. I don't like that for Israel, but I like that God shows us how that shifts. Israel in transit, the center of Israel, through the eyes of Moses and through the eyes of God, is the tabernacle space. When they get to Israel, that bounces all over the place, kind of like dodgeball. It's on the high ground. Okay, now it's over here in the temple. Now it's in the king's house. Now it's out in the field of battle. The centralized spiritual heart of Israel never gets really formed. But then you tell yourself, hey, Israel is actually an incubator, not a destination. And the heart of Israel does get formed. When does the heart of Israel get formed? Jesus. Yeah, like he is the heart of Israel. This is all the incubator in which Jesus will grow. It doesn't mean it doesn't have purpose and value, but it's just interesting to see it in that picture as well, and in that light. That's chapter 12 for us tonight. We're going to be scooting into chapter 13 next week. And so look forward to that. You can go ahead and read ahead and kind of dig through the text as we continue to pour through the history of Israel. We've got a few announcements that we'll make after the close of our study here.